Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're doing something a little different for you today. Instead of a broad sweep, we're laser focusing on two New York Court of Appeals decisions, both carrying the same name, People v. Martinez. Now, this isn't just a quirk of the legal system. It's an opportunity to see how the same appellant name can be attached to completely distinct legal battles.
Right.
What's particularly useful for you as future legal minds is that these two cases, decided remarkably close in time, delve into completely different yet crucial areas of criminal law.
Exactly. Think of this as a highly efficient way to, you know, get up to speed on some significant New York precedents. We've done the heavy lifting, parsing through the details of these two People v. Martinez cases to pinpoint the core legal principles and their practical implications.
What?
Our goal today is to dissect these nuances, explain why these rulings are significant, and ultimately equip you with a clear understanding of how they might shape your future legal careers.
Absolutely. We'll first examine People v. Martinez from 1992. This case centers on a murder conviction complicated by a defense of extreme emotional disturbance and some really concerning prosecutorial conduct.
Yeah, that part's key.
Then we'll pivot to People v. Martinez from 1991, which tackles a police pursuit and the pivotal legal concepts of reasonable suspicion and whether evidence discarded during that pursuit can be used in court.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these come straight from the New York Court of Appeals, making them fundamental for anyone looking to practice law in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's dive into that first Martinez case, the one from 1992.
Right. So the 1992 case unfolds from a truly tragic series of events. Pablo Cruz Martinez was convicted of second-degree murder following a violent confrontation in his apartment building.
Okay.
His wife had been assaulted by a neighbor's boyfriend, and in response, Martinez retrieved a firearm and discharged it 12 times at the victim in the hallway.
12 shots? Yeah. That really paints a picture of the intensity of that moment. And his primary defense at the initial trial was this concept of extreme emotional disturbance, or ED. Could you break down for us what that defense actually entails in legal terms?
Certainly. The ED defense operates on, like, two fundamental levels. First, there's the subjective component. The defendant must have genuinely experienced extreme emotional distress at the time the crime was committed. This is about their actual mental state, you know, in that critical moment.
Right, what they were feeling.
Exactly. Second, there's the objective component. Would a reasonable person facing circumstances similar to those the defendant faced have reacted in a comparable way?
The reasonable person standard.
Right. It's not enough for the defendant to simply feel intensely upset. Their reaction must be understandable when viewed through the lens of what a reasonable person would do. This objective lens is crucial because the law seeks to balance individual emotional responses with broader societal expectations of reasonable behavior, even in highly stressful situations. That's why convincing a jury on this point is often, well, a significant challenge.
Right, so it's a two-part test, looking at both what was going on inside the defendant and how a hypothetical, reasonable person would have responded. Now, this case didn't proceed in a straightforward manner through the courts, did it?
No, it did not. Martinez was initially found guilty of second-degree murder and a weapons offense. However, that conviction was later overturned upon appeal.
Why was that?
The reason. Significant misconduct on the part of the prosecutor. The appellate court determined that the prosecutor's actions had unfairly restricted Martinez's ability to present his ED defense to the jury.
Okay, that's serious.
Oh, yeah. This isn't just a procedural hiccup. It underscores the fundamental principle that a fair trial requires both sides to have a genuine opportunity to present their case. When that balance is disrupted, the entire legitimacy of the verdict comes into question, you know, regardless of the underlying facts.
Makes sense.
This violation of due process, specifically the right to present a complete defense, is a cornerstone of our legal system.
So how exactly did the prosecutor cross that line? What actions led to the initial conviction being thrown out?
Well, from the appellate court's perspective, the prosecutor improperly limited the expert testimony concerning Martinez's mental state. The defense was trying to show he was acting under ED, right?
Right.
But the prosecutor's interventions, their objections, or whatever they did, prevented the defense from presenting that expert evidence fully and fairly to the jury. This serves as a powerful illustration of how prosecutorial overreach can fundamentally undermine the fairness of a trial and violate a defendant's constitutional rights.
That's a really important point for anyone heading into the legal profession, whether as a prosecutor or a defense attorney. But the legal journey for Mr. Martinez didn't end with that overturned conviction, did it? There was a subsequent retrial.
Correct. Martinez was brought to trial again, and this time he had the full opportunity to present his defense of extreme emotional disturbance.
And the outcome.
Despite this, the jury once more found him guilty of second-degree murder. He subsequently received a sentence of 25 years to life in prison, along with a concurrent sentence for the weapon possession charge.
Wow. It's fascinating that even after the prosecutorial errors were corrected, the jury still didn't find the ED defense compelling. What do you think were the key factors that might have influenced their decision in the retrial?
It really underscores the demanding nature of the extreme emotional disturbance defense, particularly that objective prong we discussed earlier.
Yeah, the reasonable person part.
Exactly. Even if the subjective element, the defendant's own emotional distress, is evident, persuading a jury that a reasonable person would have responded with such extreme violence, especially, you know, firing 12 shots, that presents a formidable challenge.
It's a high bar.
A very high bar. It highlights the jury's critical role in applying that objective standard and their assessment of what society deems a proportionate response, even in highly charged situations.
So for our listeners who are law students, what are the most crucial takeaways from this first People v. Martinez case?
There are a couple of really critical lessons here. First and foremost, this case serves as a potent reminder of the absolute necessity of prosecutorial ethics and the unwavering guarantee of due process within our legal framework.
Right.
Prosecutors bear a profound responsibility to seek justice, which includes ensuring a fair process for the accused, not just, you know, securing convictions at any cost.
No.
Obstructing a defendant's ability to present a legitimate defense strikes at the very heart of a fair trial.
Definitely. And the second takeaway.
Second, this case vividly illustrates the practical difficulties and the substantial burden of proof associated with successfully arguing the extreme emotional disturbance defense in criminal proceedings. It's far more than simply claiming emotional distress. The legal criteria are strict and require convincing a jury on both the subjective and, crucially, the objective elements.
Got it. Okay, let's now turn our attention to the second People v. Martinez case, the one decided back in 1991. This shifts our focus quite dramatically, moving from courtroom defenses and mental states to the realm of law enforcement conduct and the admissibility of evidence.
Yes, this 1991 case presents a starkly different factual scenario. Here, we're dealing with a police encounter that occurred in a high-crime area known for drug activity. Police officers observed Martinez late at night removing a Haida key box from a store window. It's important to note that the court specifically mentioned that these types of boxes are sometimes used to conceal drugs.
Okay, so that observation immediately puts the officers on alert. What transpired next?
As the officers approached Martinez, he immediately fled on foot. During his attempt to get away, he handed the Haida key box to an accomplice named Palmer, who then discarded it.
Ah, he passed it off.
Yeah. The officers subsequently retrieved the discarded box and discovered it contained 17 vials of crack cocaine. This discovery led to Martinez's arrest.
And this sequence of events raises the central legal questions that the court had to address. Did the police have sufficient grounds to even begin pursuing Martinez in the first place? And was that Haida key box and the drugs inside admissible as evidence in court?
Precisely. The crucial legal concept at the heart of the pursuit issue is reasonable suspicion. The court had to determine whether the officers possessed enough credible information to reasonably believe that criminal activity was underway, thus justifying their decision to pursue Martinez for further investigation.
And what exactly is the legal standard for reasonable suspicion? How did the New York Court of Appeals define it in this particular context?
The Court of Appeals, in its decision, referenced established legal precedent, stating that reasonable suspicion requires a quantum of knowledge sufficient to induce an ordinarily prudent and cautious person under the circumstances to believe criminal activity is at hand.
Okay, a quantum of knowledge.
Right. It's vital to understand that this is a less demanding standard than probable cause, which is the level of certainty needed for a lawful arrest. Reasonable suspicion allows law enforcement officers to conduct a brief investigative stop, or, as in this case, a pursuit to further investigate potential criminal activity. It's like a step below probable cause.
So what specific factors did the court identify in this situation that, when taken together, amounted to that reasonable suspicion?
The court emphasized that they look at the totality of the circumstances. They didn't just focus on one thing.
Right, the whole picture.
Exactly. They gave weight to the late hour. It was approximately 10:50 p.m. They considered the geographic location, a neighborhood with a known high incidence of drug-related crimes. They noted Martinez's action of removing the Haida key box, an item that, as they pointed out, is known to be used in the concealment of drugs.
Uh-huh.
And significantly, they considered his immediate and unprovoked flight upon the officer's approach. The court specifically stated, and I'm quoting loosely here, defendant's flight may be considered in conjunction with other attendant circumstances, namely the time, the location, and the fact that defendant was seen removing an instrument known to the police to be used in concealing drugs.
So it wasn't just one isolated factor, but the combination of all these elements, the time, the place, the box, the running.
Exactly, the combination. That's what led the court to conclude that the officers had reasonable suspicion to pursue him.
So it wasn't simply that he had the box or that he ran, but the confluence of all those factors at that particular time and in that specific location that justified the officers' actions. Now, let's talk about the hide-a-key box and the contraband inside. Why was that ultimately deemed admissible as evidence?
That's where the abandonment doctrine comes into play. The legal principle here is that if an individual voluntarily abandons property during a lawful police pursuit, that property can be recovered and used as evidence against them.
Okay, voluntarily abandons.
Right. The underlying rationale is that by intentionally discarding the property, the individual relinquishes any reasonable expectation of privacy they might have had in it. Consequently, the protections of the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures no longer apply to that specific item.
Ah, so because the initial pursuit was deemed lawful based on that reasonable suspicion, Martinez's act of discarding the box via his accomplice meant that he essentially forfeited his right to challenge the subsequent seizure and use of that evidence.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's as if the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, the rule that excludes illegally obtained evidence, doesn't apply here, because the initial police action, the tree itself, wasn't poisonous, it was justified. Is that a fair way to look at it?
That's precisely right. The fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine typically operates to exclude evidence that is the direct result of illegal police conduct. However, in this scenario, because the pursuit was supported by reasonable suspicion, Martinez's abandonment of the evidence was considered a voluntary act, breaking that chain, thus rendering the evidence admissible.
Okay, so for our law student listeners, what are the key principles to take away from this second People v. Martinez case?
Well, the primary takeaways are a clear and thorough understanding of the legal standard for reasonable suspicion and how courts assess its existence in real-world encounters between law enforcement and individuals.
Crucial stuff.
Definitely. This case underscores the critical importance of the totality of the circumstances in legal analysis. It's rarely a single factor that dictates the outcome. You have to look at everything together.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it's essential to grasp the implications of the abandonment doctrine for the admissibility of evidence, especially in situations where evidence is discarded during a pursuit that is later determined to be lawful.
It's really remarkable how these two cases, sharing nothing more than a name, delve into such distinct yet fundamental aspects of criminal law.
It really is.
The first case really unpacks the complexities of criminal defenses within the courtroom, particularly those relating to mental state in the context of violent crime.
Yeah, ED stuff.
While the second illuminates the rules governing initial interactions between law enforcement and citizens on the street, especially in scenarios involving potential drug activity.
Absolutely. And the 1992 case serves as a critical reminder of the indispensable role of prosecutorial ethics in upholding the integrity of our justice system. When a prosecutor improperly hinders a defendant's ability to present a legitimate defense, like with the EED argument initially.
Right, we saw that.
It strikes at the very heart of the constitutional guarantee of due process. You just can't do that.
And regarding the EED defense itself in that 1992 case, it really highlights the significance of that objective prong. It's not enough for a defendant to have been in a state of extreme emotional distress. The jury must also be convinced that a reasonable person in a similar situation would have reacted in a comparable way.
And that's often a very, very difficult hurdle to overcome, especially in cases involving serious violence like firing 12 shots.
Yeah, definitely.
Precisely. Now, when we shift our focus to the 1991 case, it's crucial to clearly distinguish between reasonable suspicion and the higher standard of probable cause. The court explicitly stated that for an investigative pursuit that doesn't immediately lead to an arrest, the lower threshold of reasonable suspicion is sufficient.
So less certainty is needed just to investigate further.
Exactly. This allows law enforcement the necessary leeway to investigate potential criminal activity when they have a reasonable, articulable belief that something is amiss, even if they don't yet have enough evidence for an actual arrest.
And the abandonment doctrine, as applied in the 1991 case, provides a clear legal framework for why individuals can't simply discard evidence during a lawful pursuit and then claim that it was illegally obtained.
Right. Because the initial pursuit was legally justified from its inception, the act of throwing away the Heidecke box was considered a voluntary relinquishing of any expectation of privacy in that item. You ditch it, it's fair game if the chase was legit.
Makes sense.
Exactly. It's a nuanced area of Fourth Amendment law, but the key principle to remember is the legality of the initial police action. If the pursuit is justified by reasonable suspicion, then any evidence that is voluntarily abandoned during that pursuit is generally admissible in court.
So to bring our deep dive into these two distinct People v. Martinez cases to a close, we've explored how one case underscores the vital importance of fairness in courtroom procedures and the intricate challenges of establishing a mental state defense in a murder trial.
Yep, the EEN prosecutor ethics piece.
While the other clarifies the legal parameters governing police authority and the admissibility of evidence in the context of a drug-related encounter, both offer valuable insights into different yet essential facets of New York criminal law.
Indeed. And it prompts a final thought for you to consider as you continue your legal studies, reflecting on the high crime area factor that played a role in the 1991 case.
Uh-huh. That location factor.
Right. How might the application of this standard be critically examined in diverse community contexts? Does the reliance on such broad categorizations risk introducing or perpetuating biases in law enforcement practices? It's a complex question with significant implications for the equitable application of the Fourth Amendment. You know, something to think about.
That's a really critical and important question to contemplate. We certainly encourage you to delve deeper into these concepts and consider the broader societal implications for criminal law and procedure. Thanks for joining us with this deep dive into the two People v. Martinez cases.
Glad to be here.
We hope this has provided you with a concise yet thorough understanding of these intricate legal topics.